A firing squad execution. A cruel animal testing process in a laboratory. And war footage. The spacious room resembled a disturbing art museum installation. The volume was turned down completely. A silent series of violent actions repeated themselves again and again. Was this some kind of modern art? Or was it a Halloween stunt? Suspended over the fireplace was an enormous portrait of the perfect family. I examined the picture and realized that it was true. There were only two children, no baby. At least, not in the picture. "Do you want to watch something else?" I asked Jackson, who was now sprawled on a black leather couch. "A movie or something?" "Nah." I sat down next to Jackson, doing my best to bond with him. But while the silent images on the screen seemed to relax Jackson, they made me feel overwhelmingly anxious. More than anything, I felt the urge to flee the house. And once again, my body was smarter than my brain. "Hannah." I heard the faint sound of someone calling my name. "Was that Maddie?" I asked.
"I didn't hear anything."
Jackson stared at the black and white images flickering across the television screens. "I'll just go check on her." I made my way upstairs, then down a hallway decorated with a bizarre combination of technology, weaponry, and sentimental whimsy. Artifacts including swords and antique rifles were displayed alongside sappy oil paintings depicting lush flower gardens, waterfalls, and sunsets. I found one object particularly disturbing. A large Victorian-style wreath that appeared at first glance to be an intricate arrangement of dried flowers. When I took a closer look, I realized that the brown and gold petals and leaves were actually made entirely of human hair. Hair of various shades that had been braided and twisted into detailed shapes. Was this evidence of some bizarre family hobby? And whose hair was it? Now opening a series of doors in search of Maddie's bedroom, I had the disconcerting sense that it was entirely possible to lose track of a child in this house. Who knew how many hiding places there were? How many secret rooms? "Maddie," I called. The only answer was a thin wailing sound, like the whistling of wind around a house, or the plaintive meow of a cat. As I listened more closely, I became convinced that it was the sound of a baby crying. I hurried up another flight of stairs. The crying seemed to come from behind a closed door at the end of another long hallway. I caught my breath when I pulled open the door to reveal a baby's nursery. My eyes fell on a small, empty bassinet adorned with a skirt of white lace. All around the bed were dolls dressed in clothing from various historical eras. Hoop skirts made of colorful taffeta, wasp-waisted polka-dot dresses with crinoline petticoats, miniskirts, and go-go boots. My interest in the elaborate and intricate costumes worn by these dolls turned to trepidation when I noticed a group of dolls that looked like ordinary contemporary teenagers. Dolls dressed in blue jeans, dolls carrying tiny backpacks and miniature cell phones. One even had braces painted on small plastic teeth. I wanted to examine the dolls more closely, but the cries of the phantom baby were becoming ever more insistent. Strangely, the infant's screaming now seemed to come from behind a full-length mirror that hung on the wall. Now I know where that old saying, "Curiosity killed the cat," comes from. It's funny how you can feel simultaneously terrified and driven to discover the truth at all costs. Well, that's how I felt as I slowly approached my own reflection in the mirror, bracing myself for the glimpse of some supernatural vision in the darkened glass. I reached out and touched my reflection, and gasped with surprise when the mirror quietly swung open to reveal a tiny room. The mirror was actually a secret doorway. There, behind the mirror, was the source of the crying, a baby monitor with a video screen. I had used plenty of baby monitors, so I knew they were basically walkie-talkies that allowed you to hear and even see a baby from any room in the house. Now I knew for sure that there really was a baby, the same baby girl I had seen in the garden earlier that day. Wearing only a diaper, she sat alone in what looked like an animal cage. I watched the grainy image on the screen as she pulled herself up to a standing position and stood with one arm outstretched through the bars of her little prison.
"Mama!"
she cried. My stomach churned when I perceived a tiny, gruesome detail, the shadowy image of a butcher knife lying on the floor near the baby. "Someone wants me to see this," I thought. "But why?" I remembered Maddie kicking Jackson under the table, the sly smile on Jackson's lips when I had asked about a baby. I was sure of one thing. I had to find that baby. In the background of the image on the video screen, I saw the outline of what looked like a wine storage cabinet. My gut told me that the baby was somewhere in the basement of the house. In retrospect, going down to the basement by myself wasn't a good idea. But something takes over when you see and hear a child in distress. It's almost a full-body alarm that compels you to act without thinking, to run as fast as you can toward the sobbing sounds. At least, that's how it was for me. As I raced down a series of stairways and then through the family room where the disturbing screen images were still looping, I heard the patter of rain outside the window, a fall storm beginning. As a flash of lightning illuminated the Halloween cemetery in the backyard, I remembered the story of the teenage girl named Jessica who had disappeared. How many kids are buried back there? I wondered. How many families? I made my way through a library where I glimpsed a book entitled Best Meat Carving Methods, then through a game room and a reading alcove, then down the steep, dark steps leading to the Perfect's basement. I could hear the crying more clearly now, but it sounded softer, as if the child had grown weary.
"Hello? Is anybody here?"
Across the dim room, I saw the dark outline of the cage. Something sat inside. The motionless shadow silhouette of a child. Was she okay? Had she been hurt? I cautiously approached the cage until I was close enough to see clearly in the dim light. The cage door was open, and there was no baby. Instead, there was a large doll. A doll that bore a striking resemblance to me. I stared for a moment too long, horrified and mesmerized by the doll's hoop earrings, the long, shiny hair gathered in a ponytail. Several hands shoved me from behind. I toppled into the cage, and the door slammed behind me. When I turned around and caught my breath, I saw the whole Perfect family, including a very familiar one-year-old baby and two of the middle-aged ladies from the Sweet Memory Shop, hugging each other, pulling out their carving knives, and wishing each other a happy Halloween.
"My parents know where I am," I shouted, my voice sounding strangely hollow. "My dad will make sure you all go to jail forever."
"Things don't work that way around here, dear," said Mrs. Perfect calmly. "You see, we Perfects pretty much keep this town running. We have an arrangement with the townsfolk. We stay away from the kids who were born and raised here, and help keep their businesses afloat. And they keep their noses out of our culinary activities. Let's just say the police won't be terribly concerned when they hear you're missing.
Still, you won't get away with this.
I realized I was speaking to someone who had absolute certainty that she would indeed get away with it forever.
You'd be shocked at how many parents can be bought, said Mrs. Perfect. Just say the words, financial security, and never have to work again, and some of them are willing to keep quiet. Others, well, we have ways of keeping them quiet.
So there you have it. In the town of Entrails, the Perfect family keeps the town running financially, and in exchange, the townsfolk and the police keep quiet about their crimes. In a sense, my family really did move next door to a castle. The whole thing is kind of futile. If I were going to school again, I'd write a paper about it. But don't worry, I haven't given up all hope yet. Remember how I said kids always like me? Well, toddlers love me. And just a moment ago, after all the other Perfects disappeared to go sharpen their knives and fingernails in preparation for their Halloween feast of freshly killed babysitter, the littlest Perfect appeared outside my cage with an impish, toothy grin and a shiny key in her hand. Maybe, just maybe, she'll trade the key to the cage for the doll that looks like me. Kids, you never know what they're going to do.
Shadow Children by Heather Brewer. Read by MacLeod Andrews.
Good night, John. Dex pulled the covers over his little brother's chest. John was wearing his favorite pajamas again, despite the hour-long argument that flannel wasn't exactly a summer-weight fabric and the buttons were on the verge of falling off. Surrendering with a sigh, Dax walked out of the room, flipping the light switch as he went. Not a second later, John's Batman nightlight went out, which instantly sparked whining from the 6-year-old.
Dax! My nightlight! I can't sleep without my nightlight! The shadows will get me!
Dax sighed again, silently counting the seconds until Mom and Dad would be home. It was like this every night. John would whine to Mom or Dad, and they'd make sure his nightlight was working or that the hall light was on, anything to placate John's irrational fear of things that weren't really lurking in the shadows, waiting to snatch him away. Only tonight, it was Dax who was left to placate him. Bad enough he had to miss out on Janie's party to babysit his little brother, but now he was also expected to cater to John's ridiculous fear of the dark.
I'll grab you a flashlight, John. Just give me a second.
It was all he could do to block out John's blubbering as he walked into the kitchen. He pulled the drawer open and rummaged around. A flashlight had to be in there somewhere.
Dax, hurry! The shadows!
Dax found a couple of flashlights and picked one up, tapping it gently against his chin. Maybe it would be better if he did them all a favor and showed John that there were no such things as monsters under your bed, nothing at all lurking in the pitch-black night. If he let John cry it out just for one night, maybe the kid would grow up and stop being such a baby. Maybe then babysitting him without pay and missing out on the party of the year wouldn't be so bad. Dax mulled this over for a moment, blocking out the whimpers from down the hall.
It's just the dark, John. There's nothing in it that isn't there in the daytime.
John screamed, and it wasn't one of those little brat screams for attention. He sounded terrified, like his life depended on someone hearing and responding to his terrified shriek. Dax bolted back to the bedroom and stared in shocked disbelief. A long, dark shadow was looming over the bed, but it wasn't an ordinary shadow. It was darker than the rest of the room, and moved of its own free will. It was a creature made of shadows. It was alive. Part of it whipped forward and wrapped around John's ankle. John cried, "Help me, Dax!" The shadow monster was pulling John off the bed, but Dax was frozen in place, staring at this thing that couldn't possibly exist. John was flailing, tears streaming down his cheeks. Breaking free from his trance, Dax clutched his brother's wrist, but he was hit in the chest and thrown against the wall. Pain bolted through Dax's back as he hit the wall and crumpled to the floor. He struggled to sit up again, but a tentacle of the shadow monster stood in front of him, defying him to move. There were no eyes or mouth, but somehow Dax knew that the thing was looking at him. He swore he heard a growl, but it had no mouth, no substance. The shadow monster lurched back and ripped Dax's brother free of his covers. Dax ran forward and grabbed John by the ankle. They both flew through the air and into the closet. The door slammed shut, sealing them in pitch black. A sound caught his attention, like a large amount of sand falling through a grainy hourglass. It was coming from the floor. Dax looked down. The floor was moving. It swirled around his feet. The sand-like substance of what had once been a wood floor crashed over the toe of his sock in small black waves. He pulled his foot back, but the sand clung to it. Beside him, John whimpered as the sand closed over his arm. Dax brushed it away, but it seemed to have a life of its own. The sand covered him, and all he could do was lie there, feeling the weight of it curl around his feet, his ankles, his legs, knowing he was sinking into it. Whatever it was, it moved up his torso, and he felt suffocated. There was no air, only sand. Beside him, John screamed, but his screams were cut off as the sand closed over his small head. Dax grabbed desperately for John's hand, but there was nothing to grab. His brother was gone. Strangely, he could feel his legs dangling on the other side, like he was slipping through some hole. It covered his chest, and Dax took a deep breath and held it, not knowing if he would ever breathe again, not knowing what was happening or what to do to stop it. The sand swirled around, tickling his eyelashes, covering his face. He felt the weight of it on top of his head and wondered if he would ever see John again. Suddenly, the sand impacted tightly around him and just as quickly released. Dax fell several feet, landing on the hard ground below. He coughed and drew air into his lungs. His chest burned, but after a few deep breaths, it came easy again. Remembering the flashlight, he turned it on and looked around, gasping at what he saw. He was in a cavern, an enormous cavern of what must have been obsidian. The walls were shiny and black, the floor smooth and reflective. He shined the flashlight up at where he'd fallen through, but there was no sign of any hole or trap door or even sand. Only hard, black rock. The floor trembled slightly beneath his feet. He noticed the movement less when he stepped forward, but despite the floor's solid appearance, it struck him as fragile. On the ceiling, just on the edge of the flashlight beam, something moved. Dax chased it with the light, but it remained at the beam's edge. And like that, on the edge of his hearing, Dax detected a sound, like a group of people whispering very softly.
"Hello?"
In the distance, a noise. It sounded like his brother crying.
"John, where are you?"
But silence answered him. Dax called out again, but the only sound was his voice chasing after itself in an echo. The last thing he wanted to do was move deeper into the cavernous tunnel, to move away from this spot, which he feared was the closest he would ever be to home again. But John had sounded like he was getting farther and farther away, so he had no choice. He had to find his brother, and then He had to find a way to get them out of here. Clutching the flashlight in his hand, Dax moved through the cavern. All around him, he could hear faint whispers, but couldn't understand what they were saying. He paused several times, shining the light behind him, trying to catch whoever, whatever, was whispering. But each and every time, there was no one there. Dax was, despite the nudging of the darkest corners of his imagination, completely alone. John was nowhere to be found. It was as if he'd vanished into thin air. The large tunnel broke off into three smaller tunnels up ahead. Dax listened, but heard nothing that told him which one John might be down. He ran a frustrated hand through his hair, and just as he'd decided to take the middle tunnel, the whispering stopped and a new sound began. A small click as something hit the floor. Then an even smaller noise, like something rolling several feet. He pointed the flashlight down, searching, sweeping the floor for any sign of movement. The sound ceased as whatever it was rattled to a stop just in front of his feet. He bent down, focusing on the item with the light. In near disbelief, he plucked it from the ground, turning it over in his hand. A red, shiny button, just like the ones on John's pajamas. Dax stood, shining the flashlight on the tunnels again.
John?
He stepped forward, and just as he was about to enter the center tunnel, he saw movement with his peripheral vision. Taking a step back, he shined his light on the right tunnel entrance. At first, there was nothing, but after a moment, Dax thought he could hear a small whimper. He hurried down the right tunnel, clutching the button in his hand and calling out for his brother. Several yards in, the whispers returned. But though they were louder in the smaller space, Dax still couldn't determine where they were coming from or what they were saying. It was unnerving, as though he were being followed by someone without a voice who insisted on making themselves known. His flashlight flickered and went out. The whispers grew louder and felt as if they were closing in, but that was crazy. They were just noises, weren't they? Dax knocked the light against his palm. When the flickering subsided and the light returned, the whispers ceased. And someone was standing in the tunnel with him. He would have recognized that face and those pajamas anywhere. Relieved to see his brother again, he stepped forward.
There you are! I've been looking everywhere.
The child had his arm extended, stroking the walls in a loving manner that sent a chill up Dax's spine. Something about the way he moved seemed unnatural. Suddenly, but calmly, he turned his head toward Dax. Dax's trembling fingers found his open mouth, hushing a gasp. The child had John's mouth, his cheeks, his forehead, his hair, but the eyes, they were filled with shadows. The thing in front of him might have looked like John, but it wasn't his brother. It was something else, something sinister, something dark. Dax backed up, clutching the flashlight tightly to his chest. When he hit the tunnel wall, he expected it to be cool, but it was warm, almost like a living entity. Even though he knew that it wasn't John, he swallowed hard and whispered his brother's name. The John thing turned slowly, without speaking, and disappeared around the bend. Dax's heart slammed against his ribs. His breath came in quick gasps. Panic overtook him, but he forced himself to move forward because something inside of him told him that the John thing knew where his real brother was. Dax turned around the bend, reluctantly following wherever it was that the John thing was leading. By the time he turned the corner, it was already moving around the next bend. Dax picked up the pace, jogging after the thing that looked like his brother. After several more bends in the tunnel, he turned a corner into a small room. A boy was lying on the floor in the fetal position, shuddering with sobs. raising every hair on the back of Dax's neck, the John thing bent down and stroked the boy's hair wordlessly with its small, pale fingers. The boy scrambled away from him, terrified, and Dax shot forward, hugging his brother, his actual brother, tightly. At first, John screamed and pushed him away, but then, realizing that it was Dax, he clung to his brother's chest, sobbing into his shirt, soaking the fabric.
"It's okay,"
Dax whispered into his hair, not entirely certain he was telling his brother the truth.
"It's going to be okay."
The John thing tilted its head. When it spoke, its voice mimicked John's perfectly. But still, something seemed off about it. False.
"You shouldn't lie to children,"
Dax sneered.
"What are you?"
It smiled, its dry, cracking lips stretching back from its John-like teeth, which seemed sharper than John's, hungrier.
"We are shadow children."
Instinctively, Dax looked around but saw no one else.
"We?"
The John thing smiled and looked up, as if exchanging bemused glances with someone that Dax couldn't see.
"We tire of the darkness. We want to live as you live."
A small trail of colored dust, shimmering and full of light, floated in the air between John and the monster that was mimicking his form. John swooned, not at all steady on his feet. He looked pale. He looked weak. The sickening realization hit Dax that the creature was somehow feeding on his brother, sucking his essence from him and stealing his shape. Maybe it was the only way the thing could become solid. Maybe without whatever it was that it was stealing from John, it couldn't become anything more than the horrible shadow that had snatched John from his bed. Maybe it couldn't face the light before, and somehow John knew that. And when Dax had forced his brother to remain in the darkness, Dax swallowed the lump in his throat. It didn't go down easily. It was his fault. John knew that these things existed, and he knew how to keep them at bay. Dax ignored that, brushing it off as just a stupid little kid fear, and let the monsters in. It stretched out its hand again, caressing John's hair the way someone might pet a puppy. Dax jerked John from it and glared. It met his gaze with its shadowy eyes, blinking like it couldn't possibly understand why he wouldn't want it touching his brother.
"You cannot escape."
Dax gripped John to him, standing holding his brother as tightly as he could without hurting him. He looked at the John thing and tightened his jaw.
"Watch me."
With John in his arms, he bolted back down the tunnel, back the way he'd come. As he ran, the indistinguishable whispers started again, quickly growing louder until they were almost deafening. John cried against his chest, so scared of what was happening, and Dax ran as fast as he could, darting around corners with ease. The whispers grew faint as he ran. He was beating them all. Finally, out of breath and with nowhere else to run, he entered the large cavern that they had first fallen into. Dax sat John down on the ground, only then noticing that the trail of shimmering dust still hung in the air, winding its way through the tunnels. Running from the John thing wasn't enough to sever that essence-stealing tie. His brother tugged at his sleeve, still trembling, but Dax was firm.
"Hold on, John. Let me figure this out."
On the ceiling, just on the edge of the flashlight beam, something moved. Dax chased it with the light, but it remained at the beam's edge, just as before. Then, suddenly, his ears were filled with 1,000 whispery, deafening sounds. He waved the flashlight around, and terror filled him. Strange shadow creatures, like the monster that had grabbed John from his bed, peeled from the cave's ceiling, from its walls and floor. One flew dangerously close to Dax, and he ducked back, but not before seeing the image of a young girl's face reflected in its shadowy substance. The sight of it startled him. It wasn't just John that they were after. They flew from their place in the cave and swirled around the two boys, surrounding them completely, blocking any chance of escape. Each of the shadows wore the face of a child. Some Dax knew personally. The John thing had said that they tired of the darkness, that they wanted what Dax and John had, what everybody had. The creatures were going to make mirror forms of every kid on Earth. And then what? Kill them all? Suck them dry of their essence, leaving them empty, hollow shells? Panic set in and Dax gasped for air. Layers and layers of the cave floor and walls peeled away until Dax could see what they were peeling away from, and it wasn't black rock. With horrified understanding, he realized that there was no cave. The creatures were the cave. Thousands, maybe millions of shadow monsters out to replace the people of the world. Dax's heart raced. Beside him, John screamed as the shadows closed in. The floor shrank until there was only an island of shadow left. It trembled wildly beneath their feet. Dax whipped his flashlight around in desperation. On a low part of the cave ceiling, he saw a flash of color, something brown and familiar. He scooped John up in his arms and said, "Hold on tight." One of the shadows whipped forward, snatching the flashlight from Dax's grip. It threw the light down, smashing it to bits, leaving them all in darkness. The shadow monsters swarmed closer to the boys, and just as a long shadowy tentacle reached for John, Dax leapt toward the familiar sight on the low cave ceiling and clung to the hole in the floor of John's closet with the tips of his determined fingers. His biceps burned, but he pulled himself up until he was waist high into the closet. "John, get off now! I'm falling!" John scrambled from his brother, through his pitch-black room to his bed, drenched in sweat and tears, crying for his brother to hurry, hurry before those monsters got him. Something wrapped around Dax's ankle and pulled hard. It was no use. It pulled him back down into the cave, the tips of his fingers only barely clinging to the wood. He was going to fall. And once he did, those things would suck every bit of his essence away. A beam of light suddenly shined down into the hole, and the creatures backed off. Dax looked up. John was holding a flashlight he must have retrieved from the kitchen. Dax pulled himself free from the hole, his muscles burning. He collapsed onto the floor of John's closet and hugged his brother, trying to staunch his tears. But the danger wasn't over. There was still a hole in the closet floor. It was still dark. Whispers drifted up from the hole until they were filling the room. John's flashlight flickered out, as if it couldn't stand up against the growing darkness. Dax picked up his brother and ran for the door. They had to get out of there, away from the darkness, into the light. The bedroom door opened, and their mother flipped the light switch, bathing the room in incandescent light. "Where have you boys been? Your father and I have been worried sick." Dax panted, his heart settling into a more normal rhythm. He looked at the closet, at the perfect, unbroken floor. John ran across the room and jumped into his mother's arms. Dax couldn't help but notice that the trail of dust was gone. The John thing's connection to him broken at last. Holding John, placing kisses on his cheeks, their mom crossed the room and opened the heavy drapes, letting sunlight inside. It was morning. Had they really been gone that long? It had felt like minutes, maybe an hour, but certainly not several hours. She turned back to Dax with a concerned look on her face.
"Dax, is everything okay?
We were so scared that something happened to you both." Dax slowly nodded his head, even though everything was about as far from okay as it could get, and looked from the closet to the sunny day outside. Out the window, he could see the neighbor kids playing soccer. To any onlooker, it would seem like an ordinary, normal day. He turned back to his mom and released a relieved sigh.
Yeah, Mom. Everything's fine. We just,
As she turned around, John peered over his mother's shoulder at Dax, who froze. John smiled and offered a wave. Shadows lurked in his eyes, the darkest that Dax had ever seen.
The Poison Ring by Peg Carrot. Read by Elena Erica Davis.
The antiques business was fun until the burglaries began. After school and on Saturdays, I work at my mom's store, Offline Antiques. When I arrived last Friday, Mom said, "Someone burglarized Rosie's posies in the theater last night. They took Rosie's computer, cases of candy from the theater, and cash from both places." Claire, a teller at the corner bank, came in on her break. After we discussed the burglaries, Claire said, "You called about a cat ring?" She collects cat items, so Mom alerts her when we have something she might want. Mom handed the ring to Claire. The top of the ring was an oval-shaped tile with a black and white cat painted on it. "It's a poison ring," Mom said, "circa 1820. Claire looked up. "Poison?" "See the hidden clasp? It opens." Mom demonstrated how the top of the ring lifted up, revealing a secret compartment. "The rings were made to hide poison," Mom said, "although they were often used to carry a loved one's lock of hair." "How much is it?" She and Mom settled on a price, and Claire wore the ring back to work. A frail, white-haired woman carrying a faded paisley tote bag came in. "What did you bring today, Mrs. Pameron?" Mom asked. "More things from Maud." She removed a brass candlestick from the bag, followed by a stained rag doll that was missing half her hair. When Mrs. Pameron had first come to the shop months earlier, she had brought treasured keepsakes, her eyes often filled with tears as she told where she and her late husband had purchased a particular item. Every piece she brought had a history, and Mom bought them all. After a while, her personal stories stopped, and she began selling us her sister's belongings. The quality of the goods gradually got worse, but Mom still purchased some items from Mrs. Pameron because she felt sorry for her. The woman always wore the same frayed sweater, and she had memory problems. "She probably needs the money," Mom said. Mrs. Pameron took an old tin Santa out of her bag. "I'll take the Santa," Mom said, "but not the rest. The candlestick isn't old, and the doll is in poor condition." "I'll be back tomorrow," Mrs. Pameron said as Mom paid for the Santa. "This was all I could carry." "I could go to your sister's house," Mom said, "and buy what I can use." "You can't do that," Mrs. Pameron said. "Oh, no, you mustn't do that." When we left that day, we double-checked the doors to be sure they were locked, but we still felt uneasy knowing that a burglar had struck so close by. We considered spending the night in the shop, but Mom decided we couldn't let fear rule our lives. The next morning, we got more bad news. The bank where Claire works had been robbed at closing time the night before. The robber took a bag of money as well as cash and jewelry from customers and bank personnel. A teller pushed a hidden alarm, but the police arrived after the robber had fled. Surveillance video of the suspect in a ski mask and black coat was hazy. Claire stopped in on her lunch hour. "It was awful," she said. "He only got $15 in cash from me, but he took my grandmother's watch and the cat ring that I bought from you." She paused a moment, then added, "It was horrible to see that gun pointed at me. I could see the cold look in his eyes, and I knew he would pull the trigger if anyone refused to cooperate." I shuddered, imagining the scene. Mrs. Pameron came again on Monday. When she removed a pearl necklace from her bag, Mom said, "Tell me about your sister." "Maud was the oldest, then Jimmy, then me. Now I'm the only one left. I blurted out, "Your sister died?" "Oh, yes, dear," Mrs. Pameron said. "Maud's been gone 10 years. Mom and I glanced at each other. Mrs. Pameron didn't remember telling us that she was selling her sister's items because Maud planned to move. Mom said, "I can't buy from you for a while. I'm sorry. I need to sell some merchandise before I add any more." Mrs. Pameron gasped and put one hand over her mouth. Her eyes darted toward the door, as if she feared someone might hear our conversation. "But what will I do?" she asked. "If you need money for living expenses," Mom said, "there are agencies who will help you. Why don't you give me your phone number?" "I'm not staying at home now. I don't have a telephone." After she left, Mom said, "I hated to do that, but I don't like to buy items unless I know where they came from." "If her sister's been dead for 10 years, I said, "where did she get the stuff she brought in?" "Exactly. If it was her own, she wouldn't need to lie." Mom had a dentist appointment Tuesday, so I was alone in the shop when a young man entered. "Let me talk to the owner," he said. "She isn't here," I said. "I could have her call you when she gets back." "Give her a message," he said. "Tell her I don't appreciate the way she treated my aunt." "Your aunt?" "Aunt Martha brought antiques to sell, and she was turned away." "You're Mrs. Pameron's nephew?" I asked. He seemed surprised that I knew the name. "Mom has bought a lot of items from her," I said, "but we're overstocked now." He picked up a glass toothpick holder and turned it over to see the price. "You and your mother offer junk store prices to an old woman who isn't right in the head, and then you call them valuable antiques and jack up the price." I wanted to protest, but decided I shouldn't argue with him. He seemed jumpy and angry. I wondered if he was on drugs. His gaze swept around the shop. "What a scam!" He threw the toothpick holder to the floor where it shattered. "Hey," I said, "you'll have to pay for that." But he had already stormed out, leaving the door open. My hands shook as I closed the door and swept up the broken glass. When Mom returned, we debated whether or not to tell the police about the incident. We decided not to, knowing it would be my word against the nephew's, who would probably insist the broken toothpick holder was an accident. I was in class the next morning when Mom's friend Susan came to get me. "Someone broke into Offline Antiques last night," she said as she drove me to the shop. "Nothing was stolen, but the shop was trashed." Mom was talking to a police officer when I arrived. "We took the cash box and my laptop home last night," she told him. "We thought those were the only items of ours that a thief would want." Warning had been spray-painted on a glass display cabinet, and a beautiful carved grandfather's clock had been tipped over so that it crashed into a shelf of fine china, breaking not only the clock, but dozens of old Haviland and Wedgwood plates. An oak table that displayed Red Wing pottery had been overturned. Vintage postcards that Mom had carefully sorted by topic were in a heap on the floor.
"It was probably the same person who robbed the flower shop, the theater, and the bank," the officer said. "Maybe he vandalized the store because he was angry when he didn't find cash or any items that are easily sold on the street. Are you insured?"
"Yes, but most antiques are irreplaceable."
"Have you had a problem with any customer recently? Is there someone who has a grudge against you?"
I told him about Mrs. Pameron's nephew. "I don't know his name," I said.
"We'll look into it," the officer said.
Instead of going back to school, I helped Mom clean up the mess. After we swept up the broken china and hauled the clock pieces to the dumpster in the alley, I felt antsy. At 2:30, Mom said it was okay for me to leave. I needed to buy a notebook and some art supplies for a school project. After I did my shopping, I got in line at Starbucks. When the young woman ahead of me reached for her change, I saw the cat ring on her finger. I told myself not to jump to conclusions. Many antiques are reproduced. Cheap imitations of poison rings are probably being cranked out in China and imported by the hundreds. I needed a closer look. As the woman collected her coffee, I stepped out of line so I could watch her. She was alone. When she set her coffee down to add cream to it, I stood beside her and reached for a napkin. As she stirred cream into her coffee, I studied the ring. The band had the burnished patina of old gold, and fine age lines were visible in the painted tile. I clearly saw the small clasp on the side where the lid opened. It was an antique poison ring with a cat painted on the tile, and I was sure it belonged to Claire. When the woman left Starbucks, I followed, staying near other shoppers so she wouldn't notice me. I hoped to get the license plate number of her car. I removed my cell phone from my backpack and slipped it into my pocket where I could grab it quickly to call the police. The bank robber had been a man, but this woman probably knew who he was. She broke into a run, waving at a city bus. As she boarded, I raced forward. The driver waited for me. I walked to a seat in the back where I could watch the woman. We rode for 10 minutes before she got off. I was afraid I would be too obvious if I exited with her, so I stayed on the bus and watched to see where she went. The woman entered a small brick apartment building. I got out at the next corner and walked back. The sign on the building said, "Serene Homes for Seniors." She must be visiting someone. Well, it was still a clue. The police could talk to the residents and learn who had company today. I went inside. A row of mailboxes with apartment numbers and the names of residents on them lined one wall. I began copying the names into my notebook. I had written down about half of the names when the door to the closest apartment opened. I looked up and froze. Mrs. Pameron's nephew stared at me. "What are you doing here?" he asked. "I'm working on a school project," I said. "I have to interview someone who remembers World War II. He came forward and stood beside me. "You came to talk to Aunt Martha." "She lives here? I didn't know that." "Go inside." He pointed toward the open apartment door. I backed away from him toward the outside door. "I need to get home," I said. "You aren't going anywhere." He grabbed my arm and jerked me toward the room. "Help!" I yelled. He yanked harder, shoved me inside the apartment, and slammed the door. He turned a deadbolt lock. The woman I had followed was sitting on a sofa watching Oprah and eating a candy bar. Mrs. Pameron sat at a round dining table. She smiled when she saw me. "Hello, dear," she said, as if I visited regularly. The young woman muted the TV and looked at me. "Who's she?" she asked. "Her mother owns one of the stores that buy antiques from Aunt Martha." "One of the stores? Mrs. Pameron sells to other shops besides ours? Mom would be interested in that piece of news." "I saw her in Starbucks," the woman said, "and on the bus." "I knew it! She followed you! She suspects us, Brittany." The woman turned off the TV. "How could she suspect anything?" she asked. "Why else would she follow you here?" "Suspects you of what?" I said. "It was her," Brittany said, pointing at Mrs. Pameron. "She told." She raised her hand as if to slap Mrs. Pameron. The old woman cringed. "No," I cried. "She didn't tell me anything. I don't know what you're talking about." Brittany lowered her hand. "Regardless of how much she knows," the man said, "this changes the plan. We need to rob the other bank and leave town today. Now." "What about the girl?" "We'll take her along. As soon as we do the bank, we'll get rid of her." "Get rid of her now, Todd." Brittany's voice was like ice. "There are too many people close by. Even the old duffers in this building would hear a gunshot." "Help!" I yelled. I tried again to reach the door. "Help me!" Todd grabbed a dish towel and gagged me with it. I kicked at him. He held my hands behind my back while Brittany cut the TV cord and used it to bind my hands.
What are you doing to Maud? Mrs. Pameron asked.
It's a game, Aunt Martha. You're going to play too. The man tied her hands to the chair back with the lamp cord.
I don't like this game, Mrs. Pameron said.
Brittany removed a wad of money from Mrs. Pameron's bag.
That's my share, Mrs. Pameron said. You put that back.
Brittany stuffed the cash in her purse. Todd put on a long black coat.
Where are you going? Mrs. Pameron asked.
To your house, he said.
I want to go too, she said.
No, you don't, I thought, and neither do I. Brittany opened the door and peered into the hallway.
All clear, she said.
I'm right behind you with the gun, Todd told me, so don't try anything.
Please, I thought, please, somebody see me.
But the other apartment doors remained closed. We walked to a parked white car. Todd opened the back door and I got in.
Lie down, Brittany said.
I did. Todd got in the front passenger seat and she slid behind the wheel. I lay on my side facing the front seat. I twisted my hands back and forth, trying to loosen the cord. The movement soon chafed my wrists, but I kept trying. When the car stopped, Todd pulled a black ski mask over his face.
Maybe I should keep the gun, Brittany said, to control the girl.
I'm not going in there unarmed, he said. Brittany looked over her shoulder at me. I held still.
You can always use your knife, he said.
They both looked out the window.
Now, she said.
He got out. She twisted in her seat, watching me. I lay motionless. I knew if she caught me trying to get my hands untied, she'd make sure it didn't happen. 5 minutes later, the front door opened and Todd leaped in.
Got it, he said.
Brittany floored the accelerator and the car shot forward. The tires squealed as she took a corner too fast. A horn honked. I twisted my hands frantically.
There were only two customers, Todd said as he removed the mask, and they both dropped to the floor as soon as I told them to. The teller was terrified. When I showed her the note, she handed over a bag of bills.
Neither of them paid any attention to me. I squeezed my fingers together, making my hands as small as I could. The knot loosened slightly, just enough for me to free my hands. I slid my right hand into my pocket and opened my phone. I couldn't call with a gag in my mouth, but I could send a text message. I found the center key with my index finger, then slid my finger to the left and pressed. I visualized the keyboard and typed H-E-L-P. Next, I typed B-N-K-R-B-R. Last, I typed M-R-S P-A-M-N-E-F-W. I pressed center again. I knew this brought up my list of phone numbers. Mom was first on the list. So I hit center again to send my message to her. I looked out the window hoping to recognize a landmark so that I could tell Mom where I was. I saw only a stoplight.
Stay green, baby, stay green, Todd said.
We roared through the intersection. I kept watching. When I spotted the tips of two golden arches, I sent MCD. Next, I saw the red and white logo of the Target store and texted TRGT.
Nobody behind us, Todd said. No lights, no sirens.
We did it, Brittany said. A few minutes later, Todd said,
left at the next corner, where the sign says Lake Elgin. Aunt Martha's house is in about 2 miles.
2 miles? That didn't give the police enough time to find me.
Panic rose in my throat. I remembered Todd's words. We'll get rid of her after we rob the bank.
Soon, Todd said, it's the gravel driveway on the right. Park down by the dock. The car slowed. The bumpy road curved several times. "Let's shoot her in the car and push it into the water," Brittany said. "We'll be rid of the girl and the getaway car at the same time." "Hey, this is a good car. We'll shoot her and dump the body off the dock." I couldn't believe how calmly they discussed my murder. Had they killed before? The car stopped. "Let's get it over with," Todd said. They both got out. I slipped my hands back into the knotted cord. I needed more time. I had to stall. Brittany opened the back door. "Out," she said.
"Mm-hmm,"
I said as I got out.
"Mm-hmm."
"Ungag her," Todd said. "No one can hear her yell now." Brittany took the dish towel out of my mouth. "When your aunt dies, you'll inherit this house," I said.
"What?"
said Todd. "She put it in her will."
"What about her daughter?"
"She said you visit her, and she wants you to have everything." Brittany looked at the classic old house, the wide lawn and the lake view. "This place is worth a fortune," she said.
"When did my aunt discuss her affairs with you?" Todd asked.
"Sometimes she has tea with Mom and me. One day she asked Mom to recommend an attorney because she wanted to rewrite her will. Mom's brother is a lawyer and he handled it."
Todd hung on every word, believing my lies. "Where is this new will?" he asked.
"My uncle has the original. He was afraid your aunt would lose her copy, so Mom kept it at the shop. If you take me there, I'll show it to you."
"She's trying to trick you into taking her home," Brittany said.
"Uncle Zach estimated the value of Mrs. Pameron's estate at $850,000, I said. "She's leaving it all to you."
Todd's jaw dropped. "Forget Phoenix," he said. "We should stay here and be nice to Aunt Martha."
"She could live another 20 years, Brittany said.
"Unless we help her along," Todd said. "She takes a dozen pills every day. It would be easy to overdose on the wrong combination."
He said it as nonchalantly as if he were discussing what to have for dinner. Brittany looked at the house again.
"It gets too hot in Phoenix," she said. "We need to get that will. Then we'll go to Auntie's apartment and help her take her medicine."
An ancient Ford was parked next to the house.
"We'll take Aunt Martha's car," Todd said. "In case the cops are looking for mine, she leaves the keys in it."
This time, Todd drove. After I lay down on the back seat, I peeked at my phone, hoping to see a message from Mom saying that help was on the way. The phone was dark. My battery needed to recharge. My texts had never been sent. Fear and despair washed over me. As soon as Todd and Brittany realized there wasn't any will, I knew they'd shoot me. Brittany said, "Let's go, let's go," and the Ford shot forward. Seconds later, Todd swore and hit the brake. I sat up. Two squad cars, blue lights whirling, blocked our path.
"Police," yelled a voice. "Get out with your hands in the air."
Two officers approached.
"Stay down," Todd told Brittany.
She put her head on her knees. He grabbed the gun and rolled down his window. He was going to shoot the police. As he raised the gun, I attacked from behind. My hands circled his throat, jerking his head backward. The gun fired into the air. Todd struggled. I held on. He pointed the gun over his shoulder at me. Bang! I heard the